This is a collaborative work with a number of my students here, former and past. And, you know, we all wrestle with this question of spotting liars, right? And so, of course, this is going to be one of the themes going throughout the session. But I would argue that some lies are a little bit different than others. And for example, I wanted to show you just a quick video clip. I figure let me startle you into the morning session. So, when you're looking in some contexts, this man, of course, a standard question you'd be asked in any sort of police interview, do you have any weapons or sharp objects that may harm me? And of course, the man has said no. So, he gets his bottle of water, waiting to be interrogated. Okay, he's got his water. Now it's time to... And of course, we stop it there. I thought, okay, rather than show him, actually, he puts the bullet in his head, so he commits suicide. All right, so the question is, there are some contexts that we deal with that I think are a little bit different than others, and I wanted to focus on one in particular. Now, again, we all know, I think this is one audience where I don't have to say this too often, about how good are people at detecting deception in general, and what does the research show, and I think, you know, we have a really solid kind of, here's what seems to always be the case. And then similarly, in a more recent analysis, looking at clues related to deception, basically arguing that they are significant but weakly related to deception. And in fact, if you look at the effect sizes, Coe and Dee, this is based on sort of harvesting stuff from DiPaolo et al.'s as well as Sporer and Schwantz meta-analyses of looking at different clues and organizing them by where they may have in fact come from. And this is from a chapter that Elena Svetieva and I sort of put together. You'll notice a couple of things when you start to line them up. Now, again, this is just sort of off the top of your head. Some of these things we're not exactly sure, which is why they get put in both columns, cognitive and emotional. So verbal and vocal involvement, maybe both or whatever. But if there's any trend that kind of lays out of them, when you think of the clues that betray deception, those related to our thinking, those related to our emotions, and those related to behavioral control, they seem to have favored channels along the way. And when you look at the face, for example, the emotion channel seems to be the favored channel, in terms of where you see significant findings based on meta-analyses of the work. So again, this is work done by everybody. Now, one of the things we do know, of course, and it's a little fun with PowerPoint, particularly when you're not good at PowerPoint like me, is that there is no Pinocchio response. I think we all agree on this at this particular point. But within given contexts and different situations, are there some clues that may be better than others? And so using Darwin as the backdrop here, Darwin had made a case for the evolution and the basically evolutionary sort of derived and pressed for signaling systems in human beings, and one of them involving signaling your behavioral intentions, and emotions are behavioral intentions, and therefore we need to signal them. Other social animals signal their behavioral intentions, and our favorite channel, according to Darwin, and as well as some have argued with chimpanzees and bonobos, have been the face. And so this is part of the communicative system. To be a social animal, you have to communicate. If you can't communicate, you cannot be social, right? End of story. So I wanted to take a look at this as sort of part of a project and seeing the extent to which that if you actually put people in very higher stake situations, do in fact the facial clues give us anything that might be useful in these contexts? And so this is one of the things we tried to do, is to look at it. Now you can look at real life situations, but in real life situations you always have a ground truth issue, right, where you're exactly sure. And some of you I know, Alder, you've done some studies in this, and it's a harder thing to wrangle with along the way. So basically, what we try to do is create a situation, but based on the advice of the people who actually live in those situations. So we got together people who've worked in the counterterrorism community in the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and Israel. And each one of the people who were at this meeting had actually gone face-to-face with a terrorist in an interview. Now, some of them may have been Irish terrorists, some of them may have been Palestinian terrorists, some of them may be from other walks of life. But one of the things we outlined is, what are the structural features? What are the motivations to the individual involved in that particular situation? And like I said, all of these folks have done this. They've all done it in a face-to-face context with these individuals. And of course, thank the UK guys. Here you are. You know, thanks, lads. As in case you see them, this is what they look like. That's actually a joke. Thank you for getting it. I thought I had to do something about the guy blowing his head off to kind of counteract it here, right? A little sweet with your salt. So basically, this is what we try to do. What are some of the situations on it? Now, some of the pressures that you see in these situations are a little different than what we see in the published literature typically. So, for example, there are group rewards associated with, and as well as individual benefits, right? So you're doing on behalf of a cause. group punishments as well. So you're letting down the cause, as well as individual. You let the team down. The type of the participants, the people who are typically involved in this are people who care about the situation. They are motivated about it. Often in the lab stuff we do, people may not care so much about it. Okay, so your standard mock theft, you go, you find money, you steal it. Okay, but where's your psychological and personal involvement? So this is what we tried to do. We got people who were members of politically active groups, as well as the nature of the interviewer themselves and the questions that were asked. So these questions were actually designed by people who interview actual terrorists. Okay? And here's the controversial part. They were allowed to choose whether to take the money or not. Now, if you actually look at the literature on choice, mainly in the polygraph world, it suggests that if you allow people to choose rather than randomly assign them, well, first off, you turn it into a quasi-experimental design. But second is, it shows that it makes it actually harder to distinguish the liars and truth tellers. So this is something that works against the hypothesis in it. Now, again, if you're upset with choice, though, then you have to be upset with, like, studies on smokers, because people aren't randomly assigned to be smokers or non-smokers, but yet that research proceeds as well. But just be advised about that. So they're allowed to go down, look for a check. It's a check for $100. It's made out to their arch-rival political group. They're told they can steal it or not. They return for an interrogation, and then they're interviewed by a professional, and these guys, most of them were retired FBI. We did script their questions, though, for experimental control purposes, but again, the questions were designed by one of those or two of those individuals themselves. Okay? The stakes were told. If you stole that check, you have to lie about it. And if you can fool the interrogator, you get to tear up the $100 check. So you stop $100 going to your arch-rival organization. And then you personally will get $75. If you can't do that, well, then you are told that the $100 will go to the arch-rival group. You will get nothing. And then you got to sit with some headphones on and told you'll get 110 decibel blasts of white noise for 30 minutes. Yes, this was IRB approved. Okay? Because you probably ask the next question. How did they get that approved? Well, we did. Okay? If you tell the truth and you're believed, then the stakes are a little bit different. You say, okay, well, we'll split the money between you and your group, and you will get $25. There's a lot of particulars here, but in the time period, we can't go into all of them. But if you tell the truth and you're not believed, there's actually a consequence to this. Because I think one of the things that happens when you're dealing in real-life situations, even if you're telling the truth, it's unlike what you saw in a previous version of the Inbowen Reed book that said, well, truth-tellers are not nervous, they have nothing to hide, and I think that's not true at all, and I think most of you would agree. So we wanted to make sure that the truth-tellers had a motivation. If you were misjudged, there were bad things going to happen to you. Again, this may work against the hypothesis. What are we going to expect? We're going to expect, at least in one segment of this particular interview, at the section where they now have to commit to a lie, because a lot of the interview, they don't have to lie. Right? What you see is we'll see more fear, distress, disgust, contempt than truth-tellers. But not so much anger. Some research suggests, if anything, the truth-tellers show a little bit more anger. And that the liars will show more of these fake, false, non-Duchenne smiles as compared to genuine enjoyment smiles. Now, of course, this is one of these where I wave my hand and say, just trust me, it's significant. Well, I'm not going to say that. This is actually say, trust me, it's not significant. Okay? Basically, when we looked at what happened with the people who chose versus not chose, we found that they were very similar on a number of things in terms of the percentage of females in each group, in terms of the median age, in terms of the percentage of Caucasian, for the most part, whether they were from a left-wing or a right-wing political group, whether English was their first language, firstborns, affect communication test scores, NEO, so personality test, extroversion scores, social anxiety, sensation-seeking, Machiavellianism, right down the line, and even self-report. How good do you think are you getting away with your lies, and so on and so forth. The only thing that they really differed on all this stuff is how convincing they thought they were, and the truth-tellers, of course, thought they were more convincing than the liars. And then the liars thought the interrogator was more truthful, but that was not statistically significant. So here are the emotions we're going to be looking at. Are these four? What do we find? Well, what we found in this situation, looking at simply the presence or absence of those things, that you could sort them out at about 69% accuracy in terms of just the presence or absence of one of those four emotions or not on this. Now, of course, you notice some of the truth tellers do show these as well. Okay? And so one of the things we did is say, well, actually, in some of these situations, the truth tellers are saying things like, oh, I don't like that group, and they show disgust. Well, that's actually, if anything, a sign of consistency. So when we actually looked at when are those emotions being shown, and they are inconsistent, or where we can't figure out whether they're consistent or not with what the person is showing, then they classify out at about 75%. Right? Because again, there were a number of situations that looked like this, where they were asked this question, one of the questions here, and what you see is that the woman is showing fear when she's talked about looking at the check. But then when she says mating out to the candidate, she says she doesn't support him, but now she shows a facial expression of disgust as determined by our facts-trained coders who are blind independent coders to the hypothesis here. So you can sort of eliminate that one. That's, if anything, is said as a sign of credibility along the way. Here's another interesting thing. When you looked at the actual duration of these expressions, most of them were, or at least half of them anyway, were half a second or less in duration, right? When you sort of show what the liars and truth tellers. Now, by the way, the pattern, though, between liars and truth tellers is the same, which is interesting in terms of just the durations and things that you saw. But you just see a lot more of it occurring in the liars and the truth tellers. And if you actually look at it, 30% of the expressions that were shown by the liars as well as the truth tellers, 30% of those were less than a quarter second in duration. So these things are very brief. But this is why we coded frame by frame by frame by frame in order to do this. So here's another interesting thing. We asked these individuals after the interrogation, what did you do to try to fool the interrogator? And about a third of them reported that they used like a poker face strategy. I tried to be neutral. I had no expression. I was poker faced. Any of those sorts of things. So of that subsample of individuals, how many of them still showed these negative emotions despite them specifically articulating that that was a strategy? And the answer is, you see, with the liars, it doesn't matter whether you actually invoked that as a strategy or not. You still showed those emotions at the same rate. With the truth tellers, there was actually a decline. In those who said they were going to use this strategy, they actually showed fewer of them than the truth tellers. What about the smiles? Well, there's an example of a Duchenne and a non-Duchenne smile, and a horrible example of how aging affects the human body. And if you actually now look at these smiles, if you just start over looking at the totals, you see there actually really isn't much of a difference. So our hypothesis really wasn't quite confirmed that way. However, let me center you on to another part of it. When you actually look at where this is occurring in the sequence of the behavior, so the question's asked, and there's the pause, that's pre-response, and then they're responding, and then the period afterwards. And what you see is the non-enjoyment smiles and the liars are being lumped up into the response period, but not before, not after, where they're a little bit more distributed for the truth tellers. And also one of the things is the enjoyment smile, which we can argue is one of those involuntary emotional sort of things. There was really no difference between the liars and truth tellers on that particular dimension when you break them down. So let's do the standard thing. Let's show videos. Can people detect this? And the answer is, well, let's start over here. I'm highlighting you on this side of the thing. Those numbers, the accuracy for the truth tellers, the accuracy for the liars, are looking fairly similar to what you would see in the meta-analyses. However, we broke it down by let's see the accuracy for those items where the person was showing one of these negative emotions, whether they're a truth teller or not, and those in which they are, in fact, a liar. And what you see along the way here is that, if anything, it's interesting, if you're showing these little signs of negative emotion, keeping in mind these were undergraduates making the judgments, actually, they got worse as judges. If a truth teller is showing a negative emotion, actually, they're judged more accurately. But if a liar is showing a negative emotion, they're judged less accuracy. And in fact, if you look at the negative emotion absent on the far end and look at the total, that's almost exactly the meta-analysis number, right? And you look at the difference in truth tellers and liars for the items where they're not showing one of these emotions. So it's basically arguing a couple of things here, okay? Under these particular circumstances, and again, I think being guided a little bit by Darwin's sort of point of view here, is in Ekman's neurocultural theory, which flowed on from Darwin's inhibition hypothesis, that a lot of these emotions that are involuntary things are occurring in this, and in this case, they were pretty good at classifying these particular individuals, okay? The other thing to keep in mind, a lot of these things were very brief, okay? So again, 30% of them were less than a quarter second long. People are often not seeing them, okay? And they're often shown despite the person saying they're specifically trying to conceal them. Are they detected? They might be, but of course it's interesting if they are detecting them is working against accuracy for the liars, although it's helping the credibility of the truth tellers. And I had one of my students, Elena, who will be here at some point, I don't know if she's here now, but actually it's interesting when these things are in a micro level, when they're quick like that, people get a gut feeling, they actually start to feel sorry for the liars because they look a little distressed or something. So it has this sort of a weird sort of reaction to them on this. But again, we're talking about voluntary and involuntary actions here. And it may be the case that if you're looking at low-stakes studies, you may be underestimating the role of these particular emotions in this particular context. But I don't want you to think that I think it's all context in any given situation, all right? The other thing, by the way, is just because people don't see these things doesn't mean they don't exist. And just to show you, we had a paper that was published last year looking at pain and human judgments on real and fake pain. And one of the things that we found is that when people are judging this on their own, they don't do very well at judging it. But when we actually used a machine learning algorithm based on a program we have a patent for, the computer expression recognition tool, that machine could actually separate the liars and truth tellers 85%, meaning there's something there, it's just people aren't seeing it. So again, I think we conclude everybody understands that unimpeachable corroborating evidence is the only way to really know with 100% from behavior whether or not you're getting liars or truth tellers. But I think we also need to understand what exactly is the nature of these clues that we're seeing. And before we go running off and sort of drawing conclusions saying, oh, we need to do this versus that, this behavior or that behavior or whatever, I think these things are going to be very context dependent in terms of what you want to look for. And in this case, if you're looking at emotions, you're looking for emotional congruity or incongruity. And so, in fact, when you look at the image of the woman here and she's saying the same, you know, different words but with the same face, you can say, I like it, I hate it, and you see the face with it, then you're probably on a little better grounds in terms of that conclusion. But I still don't think one should do that. They should basically see a sign of fear means you're feeling fear. A sign of disgust means you're feeling disgust. And why is that in case the fact? Because if you're not doing that, you're sort of going back to this assumption that there's some Pinocchio response that should work in every situation. And I think that may be a mistake. But again, behaviors can be useful, but only if you're thinking about them as in terms of informing your quest for information, so much as compared to being some sort of standalone lie detector in that particular environment. So one of the things my grandfather used to like to say is, la verità esiste, solo bugie sono inventate, okay? Which basically means, you think about it, is the truth exists, only lies are invented. And so this is, I think, some of the things we need to keep in mind when we look at these things. So thank you.